Hey, everybody. My name is Mike. I'm now caught.
Hi.
Zoom crowd can see the top of my head. There you go. How
you
guys doing?
You got it?
Yeah, looks good. Thank you. Mike, I'm an alcoholic. Again, very grateful to be here. Very grateful to do anything that Alcoholics Anonymous asks. I love Alcoholics Anonymous very much. It's the only reason why I have anything good in my life today. Billy, it's great to be here again, to be here on Super Bowl Sunday. Wouldn't want to be anywhere else. When Billy called me and asked, I was at the gym, I'm working out, and he called and he asked me, and I was like, yeah, of course, I'd love to come out there. You know, I mean, I love being doing anything Alcoholics Anonymous. And then as soon as I hung up the phone, I was like, wait a minute, that Sunday? And then I instantly thought, I was like, man, what can I say to get out of this? What kind of excuses? And then right away, I was just like, you know what? I already said yes. I'm going to show up, you know? And it is an honor, and I need to show up for stuff like this. It doesn't matter how badly I'm inconvenienced or anything like that, because Alcoholics Anonymous, again, is the reason why my life is so good today. You know, I'm an alcoholic. You know, when I say I'm an alcoholic, it means, you know, I love to drink. There's something inside of me that, you know, has a certain special relationship with Mad Dog 2020. You know, I don't know what it is, but I tell you, I drink it. It makes me all warm and cozy. And yeah, I mean, when I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean, I don't know. I have a good story to tell, and that helps me describe it is, you know, I smoked crap, you know, once, you know, for 2 days. I came out, you know, on that third day, and I lost my car, I lost my rent, I lost my virginity, you know, and I swore I would never smoke crack again, ever. And I haven't to this day. I mean, that was like 23, 24 years ago. I never touched that stuff since. I haven't seen it since, you know, but, you know, I came to butt naked and 4-point restraints in a hospital from a blackout, swore I was never going to drink again, you know, came to butt naked in a couple holding cells, swore I was never going to drink again, you know. And there were a couple long nights when I was living in my car and it was winter and I didn't have enough gas to keep the car, the heat running all night long. I'd be cozied up in these little blankets that I found, and I swear that I was going to stop drinking. I was just going to get my life together, and it was going to, I'm going to get through this. I couldn't do it, man. Just couldn't do it. You know, it didn't matter the consequences. It didn't matter what was going on. Drinking was a solution to me. Drinking was a magic. You know, drinking fixed something that I didn't even know was broken until it was fixed. You know, I took my first drink when I was 16 years old. You know, I'd been raised a pretty good kid. You know, I was a Jehovah's Witness. I mean, there was some unmanageability in my family. You know, they were a little Orthodox. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Jehovah's Witnesses or not, but, like, you know, they like to go from door to door. They like to put on their suits and ties. They sell Bibles, give out watchtowers. I mean, we'd go to the Kingdom Hall 3 times a week. I mean, I knew, to this day, I can recite every book of the Bible. I have all the head knowledge there is to know anything about God, you know? But for some reason, as a kid, it didn't really hit. You know, I didn't really feel it here. It didn't really mean anything. It was just something that you did. It was just like the motions that you went through. And I would notice my brother and my sister, they'd all be giddy and happy and glowing. And I would always think, I was like, man, what is that? You know, I mean, what are they doing? And I just felt, and I couldn't put this into words, but I just remember feeling like not a lot of much of anything except fear. I knew fear very well. I had no reason to be afraid. You know, I mean, there was some drama in my household. My mother and father split up early because they had, you know, some different views on how to parent, you know, and me and my dad lived in a van for a little while, you know, after we were kicked out and all that. And like I said, for about a year or so, we just kind of drove up and down living in hotels and stuff. And again, it wasn't that bad. You know what I mean? Like, I had nothing to compare it to. So it wasn't like I was like, feel like I'm an alcoholic because I didn't have a good childhood or anything like that. It's just when I was working at my first grocery store job as a clerk, and some of the peers that I went to school with invited me to stay after and get drunk with them, you know, again, I'm scared. You know, I don't know how to make friends. You know, I don't know how to talk to these guys, but I like the attention. So I said yes. You know, even though I was a dare kid, just say no. You know, those witnesses, they don't drink. I was baptized 13 years old. I was baptized in front of 50,000 people in a convention center in New York City. So we don't drink. I'm supposed to be an example. But I said yes, because I think I just like the attention and I just want to make some friends. And I didn't really know what to expect. And so, you know, I remember 11 o'clock rolling around. And, you know, we're all sitting around, we go around back and there's about 5 or 6 of us and they're all like, you know, laughing and joking and there's all this commotion. I'm just sitting there. I don't know where to put my hands. You know, I'm just smiling and nodding and I'm just watching them interact with each other. It just looks like they're doing it so easily. And I just don't know how to do that. You know, I don't know how to plug myself into the situation. One of them pulls out this big bottle of Aristocrat vodka. And they pulled that top off and started going around. And I just watched what they were doing. They were just taking big pulls right out of the bottle. So when it got to me, I did exactly what they did. I remember it burning, and I didn't know what that was. And I thought maybe it was eating me up on the inside. And then it went back around, and I took another big pull. And I can't tell you, you know, how many pulls I took. But I can tell you at some point, I remember looking you in the eye and carrying a conversation with grace and ease like nothing mattered. You know, I remember for the first time in my life feeling like my skin fit, that I was no longer obsessed with this fear of what you thought about me or what I was at or where I belonged or anything like that. I remember for the first time having the courage and the confidence to just be okay with who and what I was right then and there. Nothing else mattered. And it was magic. You know, it was such a good feeling. And I loved it. I absolutely, the first night, fell in love with what alcohol could do for me. You know, and when I woke up the next day, all that fear came right back. I was that awkward, scared kid all over again. But now I had a solution, you know, and I was going to chase that solution. That's what I did. You know, I went to school the next day and met up with my newfound friends. You know, we started hanging out pretty regularly. We started doing what they did. And they were all entrepreneurs. You know, they were in the distribution business, and they were actually pretty good at it. You know, and they were making a name for themselves. They were up and coming in the world. Because my buddy's brother, he had a name for himself already. So we were kind of coming up in his shadow. And dude, I was given the keys to the kingdom, man. My newfound courage allowed me to do things other people wouldn't do, you know, and I was useful to them, and I fit right in, and we had a blast. You know, I can't really say much bad. You know, I can say that I sacrificed a lot of the principles and the you know, stuff that I was taught as a child in those few years, you know, to keep that party going and to do what I had to do and then just to stay drunk, and it didn't matter. You know, a lot of the reason for that is just a couple months in, you know, I was 16. I think I was just about to turn 17, and I got brought in front of the elders, my congregation, and because I'm baptized. And when you're a baptized member of the church in Jehovah's Witness family, that's a big deal. That's important. Your life is dedicated to them. And so they gave me a choice. You know, you either have to choose your new friends and your new lifestyles, you got to come back to the church, you know, and it was a no-brainer. It was like, of course I'm picking my new friends. You know what I mean? Like, dude, you guys haven't done nothing for me these 16. You know what I mean? Like, I've been scared, miserable, afraid, and now I feel like I'm living the dream. I'm alive. I'm having fun. I'm partying. Yeah, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And so I was disfellowshipped. And I had no idea what that meant. You know, I had no idea, but I know when we walked out of that congregation hall, my dad started crying. It was the first time I'd ever seen my dad cry. And I didn't understand what was going on, you know. Now, what I didn't know is that, you know, my mother, my brother, my sister, and all the people that I'd grown up with were going to excommunicate me and no longer communicate with me or talk to me or allow me in their lodge. And at first, it was like, okay, you know, whatever. You know, I got new life. I got new friends. And I went hard. And I partied. Like, there was nothing to live for. And I don't know if I did have anything to live for, you know, like I just lived to party and feel good. And that's what I did. And I lasted, like I said, for a couple of years. It was no, you know, no trouble. You know, I found Mad Dog pretty early on, man. I tell you, one of my first resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous was somebody talking bad about Mad Dog. I was like, are you kidding me? Like, that's like, I thought this was like top shelf stuff because it got you so drunk. It came in a glass bottle. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know. I'd never paid for a bottle. You know what I mean? I didn't know it was like $1.99 a pint or something like that, you know, but I was like, dude, that's great. And thinking back, I was like, man, I wish I didn't have to steal every bottle, you know, it's so cheap, you know, but yeah, like it was awesome. You know, it got me so drunk. It did everything that I needed to do. And I drank a lot of it and I blacked out. I was a blackout drinker. And at first blacking out wasn't a big deal. You know, people just tell you like the stories and the adventures that you had the night before. I was kind of a fighter. Like I liked to get in fights, and you know, sometimes I would come to with, you know, blood all over me. And most of the time it was my blood. And there were a couple of times when I didn't have any, like it wasn't my blood. And I, to this day, don't know whose blood it was, you know, and that's just something that, you know, it just kind of would shake off. Like, that's not a big deal, you know? And then I started coming to in hospitals, you know, came to in the, you know, naked. Not naked, you know, I don't know what it was. I take my clothes off and I go into blackouts, like I just get hot, you know. And I heard that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like, thank God, I wasn't the only one, because I really thought I was the only person that liked to take their clothes off in blackouts, but apparently that's pretty common. And yeah, so like, you know, it was just like not a whole lot of consequences, but there were like a couple, you know, bumps and bruises. And then one day I came to butt naked in a stolen car driving down Route 181. And I was arrested for that. I just turned 18. I couldn't do it a month earlier. I mean, come on. But now I'm looking at some serious charges. You know, like I'm looking at burglary, larceny, criminal mischief. I'm sitting in this holding cell in Middletown, Connecticut. And because this one from Connecticut, I don't know if I mentioned that or not. I'm sitting there, and again, I'm that 18-year-old kid, you know, and I really prided myself on being a tough guy and, like, you know, being able to, like, throw down. And I'm sitting here with some of the biggest brothers I'd ever sat on a cell phone. I was like, oh my God, where am I going? And one of them, Squirrel, I'll never forget Squirrel's name. Squirrel said, don't worry, because we're all getting ready to go to Bridgeport Penitentiary for holding until, you know, we could go in front of the magistrate. And he goes, don't worry, I've been there. I'm going to take care of you, man. Now, I intuitively knew I did not want to go to Bridgeport with Squirrel. I knew that was not something that I wanted to happen. And I was really scared. I was so scared, you know, like I was like, this is like, I could see my world coming crashing down upon me, you know? And I was standing in the line and we're about to get on the bus and I get it taken out of the line. Cause my dad, you know, who had obviously gotten the call and, you know, I was all over Fox 5 News and all over the newspapers and stuff like that. And he showed up, borrowed some money from a friend and came and bailed me out. And man, I was so relieved, you know, we're in the car and he's asking me, you know, what can I do to help, you know, what can I do to help you in this mess? And I was like, man, it's like, I just need you to stop at Alice Discount Liquor and let's pick up a fifth, you know? Because even then you could not convince me that drinking had anything to do with that. Drinking was not the problem. I needed that relief. You know, drinking in my head was a solution, no matter what the outside circumstances were, no matter what was happening, you know, whatever the conditions of my life were, alcohol was a solution. You know, you couldn't convince me that my problems had anything to do with it. So, you know, like I said, I'm arrested. I'm looking at real trouble. I'm getting put on probation. And so I did what I think anybody else in my situation would do is I fled the state. You know, I can't show up for life on life's terms. I'm a runner. You know, I'm a fighter. I'm a runner. And situations like that, if I can't fight it, I got to run, you know? And so I ended up down, this is from Connecticut. I ended up down in Harrisonburg, Virginia, pretty close to it. It was my first time in the area. My uncle had owned a horse farm in the area. You know, he was a special kind of guy. He was the leader of the first motorcycle gang in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And he is now retired down in Harrisonburg on a little horse farm that he had. And so I figured this is going to be the guy that's going to teach me how to be a man. You know, he's going to teach me the ins and outs and all that. And, you know, he gave me chores and stuff. And one of the first things I had to do was I had to cut this chicken's head off for dinner. I had to kill it for dinner. Man, I did not know that thing. I cut that thing's head off and that body took off. And just started running, and I swore to God, this is the devil coming down to punish me for all my sins. I didn't know what was happening. I was scared. I went and grabbed a club. I started beating it. I grabbed the 22. I was shooting it up. It wasn't dying. It was kicking. I was freaking out. I mean, needless to say, we had to work pizza that night. But, like, I just in general, I wasn't a good farmhand. You know what I mean? Like, chores, that was not my thing, you know? Like, and my uncle tried, but, I mean, he had his little perks. You know, he, like, literally, like he liked pain meds, you know, and I'd never really messed with them too much. But what he did was he had already used his name in all the local hospitals. So what we did was we'd take a 2x4 and we would beat up my side and get it all nice and black and blue. And we would go from hospital to hospital, faking, you know, injuries for work. And we'd get these big old bottles of Percocets, Demerol, Dem of this, Dem of that. Like, I don't even know how to say whatever it was I was taking, but it was good. You know, I mean, I liked it. And that actually, coupled with my drinking, numbed a lot, you know, it numbed a lot. And this is also, like, you know, so like I'm blacking out even more, honestly, I'm blacking out almost every night. And I've gotten a job as like a little bag boy at another food line close by. And, you know, I come to one morning and I don't think nothing of it, but, you know, I had that very familiar feeling in the pit of my stomach, like, you know, something happened last night. I don't know what, but something happened. So I got my little smock on, got dressed, got my little car, drove over to the food line. And they had a state trooper there waiting to arrest me. I was like, what did I do? I'm just showing up for work. And they told me that I'd come in overnight because it was a 24-hour food line. And I'd ransacked the place and made a whole scene. I was like, that is not true. You know what I mean? Like, I was at home. I have alibis. So they sat me down and showed me the video footage of me walking around with no shirt on, carrying a chocolate cake, like throwing it at people, causing a commotion, taking whippets, just being an animal. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I do with my blackouts. I'm just an animal, you know? And so I'm arrested again, and I'm put on probation in another state. You know, so now I'm on probation in two states, and this is pre-internet, so they don't really know about each other. Thank God, I'm not going to tell them. You know what I mean? That's just crazy. But now I can tell you that tension and that spring that we talk about is getting tighter, you know? me thinking about it when I lie down in bed at night. You know, all I can do is think about the potential trouble that tomorrow's going to bring. You know, what's going to happen? You know, what's the ultimate outcome here? Like, how am I going to deal with this? You know, my problems were just, it's just like they're piling up, and I don't know how to deal with life on life's terms. I just can't do it, you know? And so to cope with that fear and that anxiety and that spring and that tension, you know, I'd just drink. Just stay drunk, you know. And at this point, you know, I'd gone from, you know, that uncle to another uncle that lived in a trailer behind a church out in West Virginia to, you know, staying with another friend on his couch and then staying with another friend. And I would just kind of go wherever I could, wherever people would go. And I remember so clearly reading when I was new, reading in the book where it talks about Dr. Bob, you know, or I'm sorry, Bill Wilson going into like the bar stuff for being an unwelcome hanger on, and I remember those words hitting me so hard, you know, because that's exactly what it was like everywhere I went. I was like, I would just wear out my welcome. Nobody really wanted me around, and I knew it, and I could feel it, and I would try to ignore it, but it was just so obvious, you know. And so for a while, I just slept in my car. I would just kind of go, and I was young. I was like 19, you know, and I could go out to like Harrisonburg over to JMU, and I could put on my one good outfit, and I could go and party with all the kids and act like I went to school there and just sleep in my car and wake up, pass out, do it again for like 3 nights. And then I would show up for my job, you know, where I would just sleep outside the 7-Eleven, you know, and she would pick me up in the morning. We would go do my job. I was a little electrical apprentice at the time. And then one day in a blackout again, I don't really remember much, but I totaled that car, you know, and I lost my mobile home, you know, and so now this guy, Billy was his name, he offered to rent me a room in his house that he lived in right off the outskirts, right off 81 out in Newmarket. Billy was a good old boy, you know, he'd been living there for about 16 years. And man, I'll tell you what, this guy hadn't cleaned that house in the whole 16 years that he had lived there. I mean, I walked in there and there was just trash like piled up, all covered every square inch of floor, all the way up to your knees. Like just like, you know, like wrappers and trash and just crap, whatever it was, except for like the footpaths that were cut to like the chair and the kitchen and like the TV and stuff. And there was like this very distinct of all the flies in the kitchen. I mean, just a swarm of flies in the kitchen. There were flies all over the house, but not like the kitchen. Right? And the kitchen was just like, you could see it from, if you looked over at the kitchen, it just looked gray from all the flies. And you would have to go in there, but you'd have to hold your breath, you know, to not breathe in a fly. And also the smell, I mean, the smell was atrocious in the kitchen. But I would try to make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and stuff. You usually get a couple flies, a little out of protein or whatever, but I very rarely went in there. And of course there were rats. Tons of rats. Every room you walked into, rats would scatter. You know, they were just kind of just trash would just kind of move around, and you know, it was just everywhere. You know, this guy was a family guy. He had there with his wife and his two kids, you know, and his wife was there and she was nice. I mean, she was on house arrest, you know, for beating up somebody at the local Walmart. And you had the little girl who was, you know, 15, and you know, she liked the party, you know, but big daddy, I gotta respect his ground. I'm not touching his daughter. She went next door and got impregnated by the 31-year-old that lived over there. And so he came over and moved in because he was going to make right the baby, you know. And then he had a little junior who was a 14-year-old kid who was just hanging out in the backyard. He just shot and killed anything that came in the backyard. Dogs, birds, cats, deer. He'd shoot them, cut their heads off, gut them, skin them, leave them in the backyard. He never cleaned up after himself, too. I think that was the problem. It's like, he's training to be a good hunter, you know what I mean? I get it. But like, he would just leave the animals scattered all over the backyard. So there's just dead carcasses everywhere. Probably had something to do with the smell. I don't know. But there was no drainage in this house either. There was only running water. So every sink, pool, toilet, everything just had like this black stagnant water in it. And every now and then we'd kind of, you know, shovel it out and then let it build back up. And, you know, I was me, Junior. That's what they called me. So it was Junior to Billy, you know. And I rented a room at the top of the stairs to the left for $50 a week. And you couldn't beat that price. You know, it was a big open room. It had tile just like this. I swear to God, it was just like this. Except it had a nice little layer of dust on it. And it was only about, you know, 8x8 square room. It was completely empty except for a little twin mattress that lied in the corner. I remember the Star Wars sheets that came on. It kept them on there. And there was a milk crate that had an alarm clock, a gun, and a box of books. You know, two trash bags of clothing. That's what I moved in with. The box of books were a bunch of self-help books because I was going to figure out what was wrong with me. You know, never got around to it. But I remember, man, I remember that first night of lying in that little twin mattress, you know, listening to the fighting downstairs. listening to the rats crawl around the walls, just, you know, being overwhelmed with that story of self, you know, that endless tape of the revolving, you know, faces, nameless faces of people that I'd screwed over. And by this time I had done so much stuff to keep, you know, stay alive. Like I had nothing but shame and guilt and just like, I was ashamed. You know, it's the best way I can describe it is I was absolutely ashamed of the conditions of my life. I couldn't paint a picture. I couldn't paint a single line of how that 15-year-old kid that was just selling Bibles and was baptized was supposed to be an example in the church ended up where I was at. Like I just couldn't do it, you know. And it was a long, long night. And this is where my drinking took a massive turn. I mean, I was drinking purely to be okay with the conditions of my life, to be able to accept the animal that I had become, and just be okay with myself. You know, it wasn't about partying. It was about meeting girls or feeling confident or feeling good. It was just about being able to show up and walk out the front door, you know, about life just coming hammering down on me, you know. And I drank as much as I could, but I mean, I was making good money. You know, I'd get paid on Wednesday. You know, we'd stop at the local sheets, we'd cash our checks, buy a couple of pony boys, whatever else they had. We'd get back to the house. By the time we got back to the house, I'd probably be 2-3 deep already. And man, I'd have such a personality change. And I'd be feeling so good. I'd walk into that house, man, I'd be like, I'm not living in my car anymore. The heat works. I got a roof over my head. The flies, they take care of the bacteria. I'm not getting sick. The rats handle all the leftover food. Got my own little ecosystem working in my favor. Like, it's just my whole attitude and outlook on life would change. You know, everything would be okay as long as I was drunk. As long as I was drunk, I could live like that. And I had a dream. I had one dream. I was going to save up $400. All I had to do was save up $400. I was going to buy this little tow-behind trailer. I was going to park out in the driveway. It had a little camper style, you know, I had a little bed, a little TV, a little refrigerator. I was going to keep my beer in it. It was going to be clean. I was going to bleach it. No flies, no rats. I'm going to run an extension cord out to it, watch my TV, drinking my beer. It was going to be great. Is going to be my place. And I'll tell you, man, I don't know what it was, but as soon as I would start drinking on Wednesday, man, I'd be lucky if I still had any money left over by Monday. You know, I'd be real lucky if I made it to Tuesday, because that means I wouldn't have had to be sober on Tuesday and Wednesday, you know, because those are some of the long, dark nights. You know, those were some of the miserable parts of my bottom. It wasn't that I was living wrapped or animals, or that I hated myself, or that I hated the person that I was. That stuff, I just looked at that. That's just who I was. That's just what it was, you know. But when I couldn't drink, you know, when I had to live with that stuff, when I had to be reminded constantly of what I was and the things that I'd done and all that stuff, it was hell. Absolute hell. And there were long, long nights. And there were a few of them where I'd be sitting there crying out to a God that I didn't understand from my childhood with that gun, begging for some sort of strength to be able to pull the trigger and end the madness, you know, because I just couldn't see myself doing this anymore, you know, and I just didn't have the guts. I didn't have the strength. And Wednesday would roll around. I get paid, start off with those pony boys. And man, I'll tell you, that whole personality change would happen all over again. And that cycle would start all over. You know, I heard somebody share when I was new that alcohol kept them alive long enough to get to rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really believe that was my experience. You know, I really related to that when I heard that. And for me, you know, I found Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, not because I was looking for any solution. I wasn't looking for a way out. You know, I didn't know that there was an answer. All I knew was what I knew. All I knew was the life that I was living. That was it. That was my normal. You know, that was my life. And I got sentenced from another drunk in public, which are very common for me to get. I got picked up for drunk in publics all the time. And this time they actually sentenced me to the, I think it's, remember if I correctly, it was the ASAP program or something Virginia offers to drunks and stuff like that. And so I got 10, I had to go to 10 ANA meetings or NA meetings. Now I figured I'd go to NA because NA was cool. It was about drugs and I'm edgy, you know what I mean? Because I did drugs. So that's where all the cool people went. So I was going to look for an NA meeting. I couldn't find any. There were none in my area. But they had an ANA meeting down over at the hospital, not too far from where I was at. So Billy wasn't going to give me a ride to ANA. So I had to go buy a $50 mountain bike at the Walmart. And I did. And I rode about 15 miles on the outskirts of town, into town. I went up to the hospital and I showed up there. And I remember walking in and I just assumed it was going to be like drug class. You know what I mean? I just figured it'd be like, you know, every other networking event I'd been to, where I'd find people to party with and hang out with, just like, you know, learn something about the effects it has on my liver or whatever, get my court slip signed and move on with my life, you know? But this was very different. I walked into that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people, and the best way I can describe it is they just look clean. They look happy. They look comfortable. They look confident. You know, they look like the people that I went to church with when I was a kid. And I instantly felt off. I instantly felt dirty. I felt like I didn't belong. I felt like these were not my people. Like I shouldn't be here. But they were so nice. You know, they were welcoming. They came up. They offered me cookies. They offered me coffee. They were pretty girls. That was important to me when I was new. You know what I mean? Like I was saying, hey, I went back to the Brat Fest farmhouse, but they were there and they were talking to me. It was been a long time since a girl talked to me. Let's be real. So it was attractive. And so I sat down there and I'm like, all right, this is really weird and awkward, but okay, this is interesting. Let's see what they have to say, you know? And man, those people started sharing their stories. They started sharing their experience. They started putting in things into words that I had only felt. I had never in my life identified with another human being like I did that day. It was Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, they were talking about their experience with alcoholism. They were putting things into words like their blackouts, things that they had lost, the unmanageable relationships, you know, the ways they couldn't hold jobs, all that stuff, the things, the relief they kept talking about that they experienced when they drank and how they couldn't show up for life on life's terms. And now all the things that they said that they were just quoting right out of the literature, it struck home and it hit. Because it's one alcoholic talking to another, that language of the heart. It didn't matter if I understood it. It didn't matter. I didn't have the verbiage to describe what I was saying, but when you guys said it, I felt it. Oh, sorry, my tooth almost popped out. I felt it. Sorry, this is new too. Long story. We'll get there. But man, it just hit my heart. It got through my ego and I didn't have to be there. I knew I should take it out. But, I had hope. James laughed. It's killing me. I got hope. I hadn't had hope. I didn't know what hope felt like. And for me, it looked like, all right, I got something to do tomorrow because you guys were offering me to take me to another meeting. It's like, okay, I'm going to do that. You know, like I'm going to go to a meeting. And that was it. You know, I rode my bike to the meeting next night. And that was the last time I had to ride my bike to an AA meeting. You know, because after that, people just picked me up. They gave me their numbers. They took me home to the Ryan Fest farmhouse. They picked me up every single day. Every single day I got a ride. And man, I went to meetings every day for about a year around this area in the Newmarket area, in the Harrisburg area. And man, I wanted what you guys had to offer so bad. But I kept drinking. I couldn't stay sober. I wanted it. I genuinely wanted what you guys had. I really did. I related everything you guys said. I knew you guys had something going on here, but I did not understand it. I'm going to get over this. Trust me. I couldn't get the sponsorship idea. I couldn't get the steps. I couldn't get what you guys were talking about in meetings. I knew you were going to meetings, you know. It just didn't make sense to me. Like I couldn't understand listening to somebody else and taking their suggestion. I mean, this one guy came up to me and said he was going to be a sponsor or my sponsor. And then he brought me to this men's meeting. And we all sat around this basement and he asked if we could all hold hands and say the third step prayer for Mike. And I was like, what is happening here? Like this is so weird, like and culty and just like out of the norm, and I just didn't like it. And you know what, yeah, I sat there, I held hands with all these men, I said the third step prayer, I left and I drank, you know, because I couldn't stay sober. I didn't know how to make a decision. I didn't know how to turn my will and my life over to something other than me. I was so in love with my thinking and my survival skills and the way that I perceived the world. You could not convince me there was anything wrong with my thinking, even though here I was living in a rundown rat infested farmhouse with nothing to offer. I'm 20 years old. I haven't talked to my family in almost 4 years or 2 years, whatever it's been, you know, and my life was very unmanageable, but I couldn't see it. I was living in this delusion, you know, this hard delusion that I'm going to figure this out. Cause that was my motto. It's like, I'm going to figure this out. Don't worry. I'm going to get through this. You know, and I'll never forget this guy, Biker Barry. I'm sure some of you guys know him. He's somewhere around this area and he goes in the mountains. And this guy came up to me on a Thursday night at a church with a red door. All I remember is that red door. It was in downtown Harrisburg. And he came up to me And he put, he is towering of man. He's like 6'6", big scruffy beard, you know, just mountain man. Came up to me. I picked up another 24-hour chip and he put his giant paw on my shoulder and I was waiting for it. Keep coming back, kid. Don't quit before the miracle. You know, some other cheesy one-liner. You're an Alcoholics Anonymous. And he goes, son, you're going to die. And I heard that. And I believed him. And I genuinely think, and thank God he didn't care about my feelings and didn't worry about hurting him. And he told me the truth. And I said the first willing, honest thing that I had said in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked at him and with absolutely no second guessing, with no, you know, back doors or no secondary plans, I said, what do I do? And I genuinely meant it. In that moment, I was willing. And he gave me an option. You know, he said, I can either move you to, what was it? It was Ocean City, where the sobriety is seasonal, or I can take you up to the DC area where there's a lot of good young people. And I thought about it. But really what he said was there's two girls for every one guy. Not a big math guy, but I knew I liked my odds. So I said, let's go to DC, you know? And so here I am. I had to stay sober 14 days in order for him to get me into the Oxford House. So he let me sleep on his couch, you know, he let me sleep on his couch, and he had bikers coming in and out all hours of the night. They'd take turns reading the book with me and playing poker, and I didn't have any money. Thank God they didn't let me play only a little bit. They'd give me some chips here and there, but like they would just talk about AA and they would talk about the study. They would talk about all this stuff literally in one year out there. I had no idea what was happening, but I stayed sober for 2 weeks. You know, and on that second week, you know, we took my two trash bags of clothing, a bicycle that I'd bought, and we left that box of books in the trash. and he moved me a couple hours north to Vienna, Virginia, and he dropped me off, you know. And I don't know a whole lot about Tyson's Corner or the DC or, you know, nation's capital. I don't know nothing about none of that. I don't know where I'm at. You know what I mean? I just know I don't have any family, no friends. He just dropped me off at a Oxford House right on 123 in Vienna, gave me a where and when, and said, go to a meeting, you know, and that's what I did. I went to a meeting and I went to a meetings for a couple weeks, you know, just doing what I was supposed to do, going to meetings. I remember around a month when I had a month sober, I met the home group that I have for, you know, next 20 years. And you don't know what a home group is. A home group is a community in Alcoholics Anonymous that are living and breathing the principles of the steps. You know, they are doing this thing 100% of the time, the inside, outside the meeting. They leave the meeting and they're going and they're practicing what is being taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. And these guys just soaked me up. And I remember walking in and it just being a whole big group of young people and they all were having fun. And I remember they came up to me and they all just surround, all the guys surrounded me. And it just made me, they just made me feel so, I remember it was cool, so welcome. Like they wanted to talk to me. And I was like, yeah, they want to talk to me. They know who I am. They can see, you know, that. I didn't know, you know, but they were giving me their numbers and they were offering to pick me up for meetings and they did. And they just scooped me up, you know, and I started going to meetings with these guys every single day. I started hanging out with them every single day, you know, and they got me and I got a sponsor, you know, and just from following their example, you know, doing the things that they did, I started working the steps and started applying these principles in my life just from showing up and doing what they were doing, you know, setting up the meeting, you know. Breaking it down, making coffee, you know, getting there early, taking people home, driving all over the Beltway. I didn't even drive, but I'd be sitting in there, you know, just going with somebody that, you know, and taking somebody else home and, you know, listening to them to talk to newcomers. And, you know, they were going to institutions and then they were just doing what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I started to stay sober, you know, and I got a sponsor and, you know, I didn't know much about nothing, you know, and then he had me start working on an inventory, you know, and I started, I think I was as honest as the best that I could be, you know, and I mean, the resentment was, I could tell you right off the bat who I was angry at. I was angry at my mom. I hated my mother. I hated my mother for, you know, the things that she did to me when I was a child. I hated her for leaving my father. I hated her for, you know, leaving, you know, turning her back on me and turning my brother and sister against me and, you know, not allowing me to be a part of my, not allowing me to be in her life. And all that stuff. And I just knew, I blamed her for everything, you know? And I remember trying to explain that to my sponsor one time and he just cut me off. I was like telling him all about my woes and like why I am the way that I am. He cut me off and he was like, you're 23 years old. Nobody gives a shit. He turned around and walked away. And I was like, it's like, I never had anybody talk to me like that. You know what I mean? I was like, well, that's important stuff though. I got to explain this to you, you know? And so we did this fourth step that, you know, he had me write down all my resentments and, you know, we tried to put on paper all the things that kind of haunted me at night, you know, all the things that I carried around on a regular basis. And I remember when we sat down, we went over that fifth step, I started just to go off on why I'm such a victim. And I remember him taking the 12 and 12 and he threw it at me and it bounced off me. And he goes, "You're not convinced. Read the fifth step." And I did. And it said, being convinced that we were the problem, you know? And so I had to look at that and I'd be honest with him. I had to tell him my actions, things that I had done, you know, my part. And then he was like, "You're a criminal." I was like, "Excuse me? I'm a survivor. Like, what are you talking about? Like, this is the delusion that I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had stolen. I had robbed. You could not convince me that I was a criminal. I did not think it was a big deal. Up to this point, I'd sober about 9 months now. I could not hold the trifecta, which means registration, license, and insurance all at the same time. I'd buy a $500 car. You know what I mean? I'd steal plates off of another car. I'd put it on. My license would either be good or it wouldn't be good. I'd drive around until it broke down or got towed, and I'd just go buy another one. I couldn't live by the law. It was just way over my head, this idea of following guidelines laid out by another man. It just wasn't like a thing for me. But here he is calling me a criminal. I'm offended. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, excuse me. But I just didn't have a real view on who and what I was and what I was bringing to the table. And he helped me. He helped me see that, you know, because right after the fifth step, he started getting me into like taking regular inventories. You know, he just wanted me to write down, you know, based on the lenses of fear, selfishness, dishonesty, and afraid, you know, he wanted me to start looking at the things that, that I was doing. And I did them, you know, and I was like, whatever, it gives us something to talk about. Sure. But we got into the eighth step. And of course, right at the top of that list was my mother, you know, right on the top. It's like, I'm not going to make a mess, you know, to this woman. Are you kidding me? Like, I know what's coming next. You know what I mean? But whatever. All right. I want to stay sober. So we go over the eighth step and we start talking about, you know, and he wants me to write a letter. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to write a letter to this woman. Fine. And so I write a letter and I borrowed my roommate's computer and I typed it out on Word. And it was basically like, "Mother, I am now allowing you back into my life. And we can start with this clean, fresh slate. And I'm willing to forgive the sins of the past." And I remember he yanked that out of my hands. He crumbled it up and he bounced it off my chest again. And he just laughed and was like, "You're going to handwrite that letter. And you're going to start talking to your pigeon sisters about how you treat a woman." I was like, "Excuse me, I'm fine. I'm pretty good with women, right? Couldn't keep a girlfriend or anything like that. I don't even think I had a girlfriend at this time." But I was also, he was like, "You're going to handwrite it." And I told him, sure. I was like, "I can't write. I didn't know how to write." You know what I mean? I hadn't been to school since really the eighth grade. You know, and then it was just chicken scratch when I tried to write. I couldn't spell worth a lick. You know, I still can't spell with nothing. I use speech to text and they give me so much shit for it, but I need it, you know, but he told me, so what he did was he went downstairs and he printed out the alphabet in cursive, you know, on paper. And he handed it to me. It was the whole alphabet in cursive, uppercase and lowercase. And he said, "You're going to practice on your 10 step inventories." So that's what I did. I got a little notepad and I started every night, start practice writing, you know, what my inventory was. And now I'll tell you, I got those inventories still to this day. And it literally looks like a four-year-old is doing like self-searching, you know? But over the course of a few weeks or months, because I stayed on it. I mean, I stayed with it. I was regular with my practice. I practiced those inventories on a regular basis, you know? And when you're practicing your inventories on a regular basis, we talk about it in the 10th step, like it is a practice. And you start to see deeper and deeper. And you start to see a little more clear. And you start to see a little more focus. And I actually started to see how my actions started affecting the world around me. You know, how my behavior mattered when it came to the personal relationships in my life. And I saw how I was plugged into that, you know, and it was like mind blowing. Like, man, all right. Well, so anyways, long story short, about 6 months goes by and I'm ready to write a letter. So I write another letter to my mother, you know, and I write just, you know, this is where I'm at. This is what I'm doing. Life is good. You know, I got new friends, you know, not living in a car, you know, not super knowing any of that. Like, I just basically, it was just a check-in on where I was at. It was only a couple of paragraphs. It was nothing much. I put it in, sent it off. You know, didn't think anything of it. Just kept doing my day. I was going to meetings. I was, you know, being of service. I was going, bringing in institutions. I was helping new people. I was starting to sponsor people. I'm starting to build relationships in my life. I'm starting to feel pretty good. You know, I'm sober about a year at this time. You know, I'm getting close to a year, and or I'm a little over a year, and I'm sober. And I like the life that I'm living, you know, and I'm for the most part comfortable, and I'm plugged in with a good group, and we're doing regular things, and we're staying sober. And then I get a letter back from my mom. First contact in, I don't know what, by this time, 5-6 years, you know, and I opened it up, and man, I tell you, I've got that huge, giant feeling in my chest. It just felt like I was being ripped open, and it was expanding, and I didn't know what to do, and I was scared. I had sat down with my pigeon brothers, and I started to read it. And it was, of course, a 4-page essay on how I'm going to die in Armageddon, and I need to come back to the truth, and I'm not welcome in their life anymore, you know, and I knew it. And I took that back to my sponsor, and I said, see, I told you, you know, and he said, you're going to write her every month. And he's going to check in with her and let her know. I was like, oh, this is so dumb. But I did. I wrote that woman every month and got very few responses. But when I did get a response again, it was all about how I'm going to die in Armageddon and I need to come back to Jesus and it's all going to work out when I come back and be a part of their lives again. And I just did it, you know, and I don't know when it was. It was about 2 years sober. You know, I'd had a hard time with the God thing. You know, I really did because I had so much head knowledge. I had so much ideas, old ideas, so much core childhood wiring. You know, but I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believed in the principles being taught here. I believed if I came here and did the things that you guys were doing, then my life would get better, you know, and I did that, you know, and my life was getting better. And I remember, you know, still feeling like, you know, the amends process wasn't getting completed, you know, nothing was really coming of it. I'd have done other little amends and they were fine, but this was like the big one. This is the one that carried around the biggest amount of hate inside of me, the biggest amount of pressure, you know. And I remember going up to my sponsor about 2 years sober. And I said, you know, do I need to go back to the truth? Do I need to go back to being a Jehovah's Witness to complete the amends with my family? And he says, no, you have to find your own truth. And I'll tell you, when he said that, it hit me like a ton of bricks that here I was sober for 2 years with a career, with a life. You know, I was an electrician. I'd just gotten my license as an electrician. I had friends, I had girlfriends. You know, I had a nice little house that I was living in with roommates, and I was happy. And I didn't need any of that garbage in my system to make me feel any of those things or to have any of those things or be able to enjoy any of those things, you know? And I knew right then and there that that was my truth, you know? And that was pretty powerful for me because that kind of changed. That kind of changed my ability to really seek, to really search for something, you know, to really go out there and find and to personalize this relationship that I have now today with my God, you know, and to try to speed things up a little bit. So I'm sorry, I got about 10 minutes left. About 6 months later, I was walking along the beach out in Ocean City. We used to go to Ocean City a lot, me and my friends. And I got a phone call from a random number on my phone. And I answered it. And it was my mom. And I had left my cell phone and all the letters that I ever written. And we hadn't talked, you know, anything like that. And it was really weird. It was like one of these like PBS back to school specials, you know, you're walking along the beach and here I am like talking to my mom on the phone for the first time, you know, in almost 8 years. I'm like, what is that? Like, wow. And we're just talking, have a nice little conversation. And, she tells me about what's going on with her life and talking about, you know, how she started having these strokes and stuff. And I was like, oh man, like, what's that like? You know, she's like, oh, I walk into rooms and, you know, I forget why I walked in there. And I was like, oh, that happens to me all the time. And she laughed. And when that woman laughed, something in my chest exploded. I had never felt that before. I'd never in my life experienced that feeling in that moment. But what I understand it is love. And in that moment, I loved my mother. You know, and I said this was nice and that I'd like to do it again. And she said no. And that was okay. And I said, okay. And I hung up the phone and I did not hate that woman anymore. And for some reason, my entire outlook on that relationship completely changed to where this was her beliefs. This is what she believed in was the right thing to do. And that was okay. And then I knew what was going on with her. I knew what was going on with my brother and sister. She knew what was going on with me. It might not have been the relationship that I would have chosen, but it was a relationship and it was good enough. And I'll tell you, man, when that wall came crumbling down, it just opened me up to being able to have real relationships, to have true friendships, you know, and And not that long after that, you know, I'm walking in to a meeting. I'm running late, and my brother and sister were coming into town, and I'd been writing them letters and stuff, and they hadn't really responded. But they were coming into town. We were all going to get dinner because my dad was going to be in town too. And my dad has always been by my side. And I remember he had to call me and said, my brother and sister basically said that if I show up, they won't, you know, and that 2-1, he had to disinvite me. And I said, okay, I understand. And I hung up the phone, and I remember dropping my ears. I just remember crying outside this meeting because I just didn't think of the answer was that I wasn't going to get the happy ending that I always hear people talking about, you know? And I remember right around the corner, this guy, big JD, big man, I mean, just a behemoth of a man. He comes by and he picks me up and he asks me what's going on. And I said, I told him what was going on. He goes, it's okay. We're your family now. And he just gave me a giant bear hug. And I'll tell you, man, that has been absolutely true for me. Ever since then, I've never not had somewhere to go on Christmas. I've never had not had somewhere to go on the holidays or anywhere. I've had amazing, beautiful friendships and relationships built around me where I genuinely can sit here and tell you that I have beautiful sisters that I love, even though they're annoying as shit, or I love them to death. Like, I genuinely know what it's like to have a family today because of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I get to show up for them. I get to go to their weddings and I get to play with their children and I get to hang out with them and I get to live with them and I get to work with them and they make my life complete, you know? And real quick, the last thing I'm really sure about for the next couple of minutes, well, hopefully I talk about what's all said, but you know, like, I mean, my life, like I was an electrician for a long time and I didn't know what to do. And you know, my life has absolutely just been blessed. Like I ran out of work in about 2012-ish, and I didn't know what to do. And my sponsor told me I had faith, show up and help people. You know, and that's what I did. I showed up and I helped people. And I was scared. You know, I didn't know, you know, if I was going to pay the bills or anything like that. And a buddy of mine offered me a job at this copier company as a dispatch person. I was like, excuse me, I'm an electrician, I'm licensed, you know what I mean? I can make good money, like that's my job. And my sponsor reminded me that I didn't have a job, so I should say yes. And so that's what I did. And he told me that I was, you know, and I felt like I was too good for this job and all that. And he told me that I was going to show up and then I was going to treat it like a service position. And then I was going to, you know, ask whatever I can do to be assistance. Didn't matter. I was not allowed to say that that's not my job. And I just had to show up and help. I've been with that company for 10 years. I got introduced into the, now mind you, I still, again, don't have an education beyond the eighth grade that is still true to this day, you know? But I got introduced in the IT world, you know, just because of my willingness to help, they allowed me to be a help desk technician, which got into infrastructure, which got into engineering, which got into sales, solutions engineering. So I've built infrastructures for companies like Under Armour. I've, you know, sat, you know, across the table from CEOs and they've asked me what my opinion was and they genuinely wanted it. And I remember sitting there being like, I don't know, like, I don't know what to say, but the right thing always came out. And thank God for Google. Google's an amazing tool. Yeah, it'll help me do anything. And that's the only reason why I have a good job today. No, I have a job today because Alcoholics Anonymous provides. Alcoholics Anonymous takes care of it. If you bring the principles in every aspect of your life outside what you learn here in this book, if you can take that out into everyday life, you know, you will be taken care of. You know, I have an amazing career today. I mean, the physical stuff is great. You know what I mean? But the fact that I can sit here and I can look you in the eye and I can be 100% comfortable and confident with who and what I am today is an amazing gift. Say that I can genuinely feel love and compassion for another human being, that I like who I am today, that I am not ashamed of any of the actions that I've taken in the last 48 hours. That's a big deal for a guy like me. You know, and I don't need any sort of alcohol or mood altering substance in my system to have any of that, you know, and that is the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. The rest of it is a byproduct of good living. You take those principles, you know, that you learn in this book and that you apply that usefulness, because that's really all it comes down to. If you're new tonight, I mean, I'm telling you, like, yeah, like my life is good and all that, but none of that's promised. The only thing this book's promised is that you'll be a servant. That's it. You know, you're going to be a servant. You're going to serve people. You're going to help a lot of people. And for a guy like me, that's an amazing gift. You know, for a guy like me to be able to show up and experience the life that I get to experience, I'll help somebody. You know, I'll drive here on Super Bowl Sunday and give a talk and tell you guys what's going on. You know, any day of the week. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the reason why I get to enjoy the good life that I have today. So I'm forever grateful for that. Thank you for sharing. Yeah.